Early Breakfast, 7:02, This Morning.
On the line with Steve Litzek, Executive Director at Access Chapter 2. As promised, we're discussing the issues with Home Affairs and how they manage those different engagements with the LGBTIQ community. Steve, thank you for joining us and welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you so much. Good morning to you and to the listener.
So, Steve, I am a cis heterosexual man, and we are one of those people who are really much uninformed when it comes to these issues. Just to lay the platform correctly, how should I refer to you and why? It's just a bit of an education exercise. I'm exposing my ignorance, and I'm asking how should I, which terms should I use, etc., just for the sake of the engagement.
So my pronoun is a she, mm-hmm. And I mean, as a lesbian woman myself, so I don't identify as a he, but the name Steve I got when I used to play soccer, That's how it came about.
Can you just tell us more about what is happening with Home Affairs officials and how they're conducting themselves when handling matters that concern members of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex community? What's the status currently?
So for some time, you know, there has been very limited data, you know, on the prevalence around discrimination, hate crimes, and stigmatization against LGBT persons. And, you know, we have been documenting experiences of LGBTI migrant refugees and asylum seekers. Mm. And what we have found out, you know, we found out to have some increased number of victimization. And we've done a very small sample, of course. But the challenges that refugees and asylum seekers are experiencing, you know, including human rights violation, but also the double stigma that goes with xenophobia and homophobia in this regard has become really repeatable, you know, for the community. What we've also seen is really experiences of harassment, ill-treatment, humiliation. People are asked questions like, you need to prove your sexual orientation, even though, you know, when 1/6 refugee or asylum, you are expected to prove the ground that you are claiming you seeking that asylum or refugee. However, you know, the questions are really problematic in a way that undermines and humiliates somebody. And I mean, I don't understand why would we even ask a question of, we want you to prove, actually prove to us that you are gay. Show us you are gay. How should one do that? Even, you know, you need to construct a question that looks at the history or that specifically speak about, you know, how one puts that into vulnerability. But also part of, you know, the research that we released has raised issues of access to services. By the time people don't have legal documents, you know, you limit their movement, you limit their livelihood in a country, and particularly issues of access to services, whether it's health, whether it's economic opportunities, they are also exploited, you know, in experiencing poverty, homelessness, you know, and many who find themselves in having survival sex work, and that is the biggest issue that came out as well. Yeah.
Can you tell us more about survival sex work? And it's a new term for a lot of us. What is survival sex work?
Well, I mean, survival sex work in this, you know, you opt to engage in sex work as a way of surviving. You know, it's not a choice. It's different, a complete, you know, different to commercial sex work. You know, it's a transactional sex work that you are exchanging, you opting to survive. You get to have money. That's how you get, that's your source of income, in a way, because there's no work opportunities. You can't be a waiter or you can't be a security or any other an economic opportunity or job opportunity in this regard because you do not have legal document. So in the absence of that, what else can one do if you're homeless, you're hungry, and you do not have anywhere to go?
Can you tell us more about commercial sex work? Because I know there have been laws, there's even been a push to legitimize sex work itself, to protect those in that type of environment. It's also very hypocritical of us as society, because fundamentally we are criticizing sex workers, and at the end of the tunnel, they have customers. Where do those customers come from?
You see, I think one of the most important things is to acknowledge the fact that there's a resolution taken that has proposed that South Africa decriminalize. It's unfortunate that we are taking too long. We have a law, which is a colonial law, you know, in the 1950s that was put to criminalize sex work. Sex work, you know, in this regard, it must be a consensual sex work. Once it's consensual sex work, that means that you've got two adults who have opted to have sex, and you have an adult who has in return in this what we call commercial. There's a return in terms of that. That means that they have regarded sex work as work in this case. It's completely different when you speak about in case of transactional sex. Transactional sex in the case of young people who engages on transactional sex, they're not regarding it as sex work. It's a condition, it's a circumstance that people find themselves in, that they would opt to have sex in order to get something, whether to buy bread, to buy airtime, to buy clothes. It's a circumstance issue when you speak about transactional. But when you speak about sex work, it's regarded as consensual, and it's regarded as a labor issue. Now, in the case of South Africa, we have not decriminalized. However, it's the biggest challenge that we've seen, and South African National AIDS Council have proposed the decrim because it is one option of reducing HIV infection and also ensuring that sex workers are also not at risk of, you know, contracting HIV, and also they can be reached and be put on treatment. You know, it's a part of a solution to the epidemic we see ourselves or we find ourselves. But also to realize sex workers are human beings, are South Africans, they are citizens, and they've got rights. And why are they not protected for the fact that they engage in a consensual sex work in this regard?
It's very true, because we know that more than 80% of trans women in Gauteng have not applied for a gender marker change of the identification document due to the lengthy waiting period associated with the process. Can you give us more insight on that challenge?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the issue affecting trans persons, I mean, it's also one of the big issues. I mean, trans women who find themselves neglected or rejected by their own families, you know, what we are picking up is that in the case of Home Affairs or in the case of Department of Health, here we're talking about trans persons who have a identity document that does not match their gender identity. And I mean, you know, 80% is a very big number. It's, you know, it really does speak to a proportion of exclusion and not accessing services. It's very much problematic because people do not understand or do not know their rights and do not know the information of how to get access to the right identity documents, access to services where you get psychosocial support, where you get hormonal treatment, where you get also surgical care. Trans persons have got specific needs as opposed to cis individuals, as opposed to those who identify as lesbian and gay. Trans individuals do need specific services like hormonal treatment and surgical care and different identity documents. Now, with our legislation that we have, Act 49, this is a sex exchange law or sex description that, you know, you can access. Once you go through this process, you can, of course, change your gender marker. You don't have to go physically into terms of changing your biological sex, but you can still get it as identifying as transgender when you start your hormonal therapy. By the letter of that a psychologist or psychiatrist, you can do that. But what was interesting, on the 25th of May, the World Health Organization have removed gender dysphoria as a diagnosis of mental illness, which then means that these laws would definitely change because it has been depathologized. Mm. You do not need somebody to diagnose you of gender dysphoria in this case anymore, because it has that category and that classification has now been removed as a mental health illness, which has in the past pathologized an identity of trans persons.
So, there's a lot of also misinformation. There's a lot of ignorance as well. But we know that at least 54% of respondents from the Why We Matter, part of the I Serve Equality campaign. Some of the report on transgender rights showed that 54% of respondents came from Johannesburg, 26% from Tshwane, and 20% from Ekurhuleni. What do those demographics tell us?
I think what the demographic tells us is that it's urbanized, and what we also got to unpack as part of the limitation of that study, it could be that the people that have moved, as you look at the big number, 54% in the city of Johannesburg, it could be that people are coming also from Ekurhuleni or West Rand. They've just moved to the city. Mm. We're trying to look at as much argument as possible. I mean, we're looking at, even when we explore some of our programs in terms of engaging with trans persons, across the country, people are coming from rural areas, people are coming from villages, from township. And because of where the information is, you're more likely to find that people are just situated in an urban area where it's more likely to have services. Now, if you look at that study itself, you already know that people who have access to treatment or hormonal care, it's people who access treatment from Baragwanath Hospital. Those in Tshwane, they access it in Steve Biko and so forth. And this is one of the biggest challenges where the services are. But when you go to Ratanga, which is the Heidelberg area, the city area in the Vaal, there's no kind of service that will address the needs of trans person. When you go outside to Carltonville, the furthest of these areas, you do not find yourself getting service. So people end up moving into cities where they can get access to service or where they cannot find themselves discriminated or violated in any manner. But what we are also then seeing is that the city area is not as welcoming as we would expect it. That's why we are realizing high numbers of violence, high numbers of discrimination. Trans person, that study was also indicating the lack of economic opportunity, where you find trans people being discriminated because when they walk into a interview room to saying, I'm here for an interview, they do not measure their own competency. What is being questioned in this regard is their gender identity.
Speaking to the director at Access Chapter 2 director, Steve Letzike, and she said that society was not coping with transformation and how diverse people were. We would like to discuss this and more after the break. It's 13 minutes before 6 a.m.
Joanne Joseph.
Weekday afternoons, 3 to 6.
When did you know that you had talent for performing?
I've always wanted to act since I was really young, but I only realized that it was something that I could do once I started doing musicals. I grew up with kids are supposed to be seen and not heard from, which I was okay with because I don't like talking that much. But whenever I was doing drama, my views and my perspective was something that was valued for the first time.
Nomzamo Mlengana heading off to the Juilliard School of the Arts.
Joanne Joseph.
On 702.
The curious.
LFP's turnkey BEE aligned skills development solutions make BEE compliance an achievable goal. We offer learnerships that are strictly aligned to BEE guidelines. Our solutions give the opportunity to implement skills development in your business whilst gaining maximum BEE points at the fraction of the cost. Our off-site simulator and eCampus both enable clients to claim all incentives such as tax rebates and grants towards their skills spend. Let LFP be your BEE-aligned skills development partner. LFPtraining.co.za.
If you're the victim of a road accident, medical malpractice, or other injury caused by the negligence of others, MED attorneys will not only stand by you on your journey to physical recovery, but will also fight to ensure that you receive the maximum recovery of financial damages caused by your injuries. call 0800-MEDLAW or visit medlaw.co.za and get a team of lawyers who believe in access to justice through a no-win, no-fee arrangement and a free first consultation. MED Attorneys, a journey towards recovery and a brighter future.
In the age of artificial intelligence, at Morningside Dispensary, you still get the human touch. Their state-of-the-art dispensing robot will fetch and speed up your order, giving their pharmacist extra time to spend with you. Now, how's that for building on 44 years of incredible service? So, pop in, grab a cup of coffee, and enjoy their friendly service, and see their robot. Morningside Dispensary, at The Wedge, open 365 days a year till 9 p.m.
Early Breakfast
on 702
for the curious
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
If you've just joined us, so we're in conversation with director at Access Chapter 2, Steve Letzike. Steve, thank you so much for the insights and as well as the information this morning. So I just wanted to discuss the specific challenges when it comes to access to the Department of Health, Home Affairs, and Education. These are law-abiding and tax-paying citizens. Why are they being discriminated against?
Well, I think one of the big issues that we have is lack of accountability. You know, when officials, take responsibility to serve the people of this country, part of it is Bartopelli principle, which you put people's cell first. You cannot put your own view or perspective. You have no obligation anyway to put your own view or any other perspective before. Secondly, we've got a constitution that is not respected by the officials. I mean, a constitution we've had for so many years. It's over two decades that we've had this constitution that speaks about non-discrimination, freedoms, and equality. And yet, we as a country, we fail to ensure equal service to all. And that's the biggest challenge. And the lack of accountability thereof perpetuates the stigma and actually puts people at risk. People end up not even accessing service for that matter. And I think, because we have not been consistent with our own accountability frameworks and, you know, holding people to account, that's why people find it very easy to get away with murder in this case. And
we're all complicit. Even those people who don't do anything are complicit to this.
Absolutely. You see, when you are a bystander, when you see another person being treated in that manner, humiliated, and we don't correct it right there, then that's a problem. Because for that matter, that means you are also a bystander. In fact, you are also perpetuating the stigma and discrimination.
How do we stop it, Steve? How do we inform ourselves? Because sometimes you see something wrong, you know it's wrong, but you don't have the right information, you don't have the right words, you can't say it with your chest. And there's the whole tricky discussion about allyship, but I think we'll get into that later. How do we make sure that we aren't complicit? Because if you do nothing, you're almost as bad as someone who's actually dishing out the intolerance, dishing out the abuse. What do we do?
Asanda, you see, discrimination is discrimination. You might not have information around LGBTI issues or what, you know, the different terms mean, or how can you be of best service, or even how you can pronounce people in the right manner. You might not have that, but discrimination is discrimination. Somebody has been humiliated, somebody's rights have been violated. So for me, how you stop it is that you stop immediately, you raise that issue and you say you cannot. And if somebody's been treated wrong, then say, look, let me assist this person because you are failing to do it.
Yes.
You know, so for me, I think it starts with individual. The fact that we want to act ignorant actually does display our mere ignorance and our own level of dissatisfactory of services, in this case, that we will not be able to put a very good, competent service in front of anyone. So I think for me, that's that. The second thing is that people must report this human rights violation. I think even anyone, you know, whether gay, lesbian, straight, anyone who feels discriminated in any way must report. There are processes. The reason why complaint procedures are put in place was to really address incompetence. The reason why we have
all these processes, people must be able to lodge complaint and to say, I have received, you know, humiliating treatment in the service, because that's how you measure quality. That's how you measure competency. That's how you hold people to account. So for me, we do need those who are victimized to stand up as well. We do need them to speak out.
Yes.
But we also need those at service point around, because people don't work as individuals. If you walk into a police station, there's more than one person on the front desk. And if you hear somebody being discriminated, you should be able to stand up.
So let's handle this from the start, top, quickly. You just got a minute left, Steve. For all of those department heads, the HODs, the managers, the people who are holding power and are able to hold their employees accountable and subordinates accountable, what should they do? Where do they start? Because those, we must start at the top, I'm sure.
Of course, diversify services. That means if at all we have not had a practice of diversity in the environment of our workplace, you must train people, you must sensitize, you must actually ensure that the messaging is it's broader than just a heteronormative message. That means you have posters that does not only have a man and woman and two kids only. You have a poster that has two girls holding hands or two men holding hands. So you need to diversify the environment. But also you must make sure that you are intentional in speaking about equality and quality of services. So for me, those who hold power must not negotiate incompetency in the space, because that's why our own service delivery was affected in the country, because we have failed to hold officials to account.
And just quickly, Steve, where can our listeners empower themselves further with just extra information, social networks, numbers, and any emails for any possible partnerships?
Access Chapter 2, it's, you know, working in 5 provinces, Gauteng, Eastern Cape, Mpumalanga, Limpopo, and Free State. And you can really actually get hold of us on 010-100-3177. Our website, www.ac2.org.za. And you can find us, of course, on social media, Facebook and Twitter, on Access Chapter 2.
Thank you so much for your time and all the best for the future. Steve Letsike, Executive Director at Access Chapter 2.